You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. So today I'm really excited to have Ryan Holiday on the podcast. Ryan is an author, media strategist, and entrepreneur. His books include Growth Hacker Marketing, The Obstacle is the Way, and Ego is the Enemy, which is his latest book, which just came out yesterday. Thanks, Ryan, for chatting with me.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again.
Wow. Yeah, it's always good to talk to you. Wow.
Do you remember how we met?
Yes. Oh, I was just thinking about that the other day. Yeah, you don't know from my perspective. So we were both there to have dinner with Neil Strauss, which is right. Why we were both there. And you were just like so nice. Like you were so like, well, you made me feel so comfortable. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't
even know it was you. I don't know if it was Ryan Holiday, but you were like, you made some joke as well. You're like, yeah, I know a man. Like I said something stupid. You're like, I know a man. And I was like, oh, I really like this guy. And then it turned out like it was like Ryan Holiday that we're having dinner together. So it was pretty cool.
That was forever ago.
Oh, I feel like I've changed. Maybe that's the narrative I've created now. I read your book, I think about everything differently. But how do you feel like you've grown since that was maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
No, it was more than that. Yeah, it was 2011 probably. So I'd written my book, but it was still being edited. It hadn't published. So I was very much not in any way public person at that point, right? Like I'd only worked for very public people, but I was just a behind the scenes person. So I was sort of right on the cusp of, you know, releasing my first book and that sort of coming out in that sense. So I think I was much more introverted then. I was much less confident then. In some ways, life was easier then, obviously, because there was less, you know, responsibilities and stuff. But I see that as sort of being right before a lot of big things happen. So I think about it very fondly.
It's so funny. So that was the exact moment my life was like, I was working my first book, Gifted. And yeah. I was like so nervous, like this first book's going to come out. And I think I was a lot more quiet then. I was a lot less confident. Sure. So literally everything you just said. And then it's kind of like this arc of what happens. And then I read this, you know, between this book, you kind of get to a point where then you're in the public and you're like, oh my gosh, like all of a sudden, I don't know, I found myself becoming more self-critical and then through becoming more self-critical and that, then becoming more confident, like kind of needing to fall back in order to move into and sort of have more stability. It's just kind of this interesting back and forth process. What's it been like for you?
No, I agree with that. It matches with my experience. I think you mentioned the narrative thing earlier. Maybe you've experienced this, but one of the weird parts is that, you know, you do these podcasts and you do radio and media and speaking events. And you end up hearing, like what we just described was, you know, 2011 to 2016, that's a, you know, 4+ years, a lot of work, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of really good times, some terrible, scary times, you know, lots of stuff is in there. But as you do press, all of that immense amount of life, a half decade, is compressed down to like 2 sentences, and they're all positive sentences, right? They're all about like all the great things that you've done. And so I think one of the hard parts or one of the things you have to remind yourself of is little moments like what we were just talking about. So you don't tell yourself you're on this like, you know, rocket ship to success, or that, you know, it was all fated. You know, you've got to enjoy and be very aware of the complexity and nuance of that time and not to sort of brush over it.
Absolutely. And so at that point, have you already worked with Tucker Max? Have you already worked with Dove?
I had. Yeah. So this was like my sort of coming out from a lot of those things. But, you know, and I had a bit of a story even then, in the sense that it's like, you know, I dropped out of college, and, you know, you could tell yourself like, I'm this dropout and I'm sleeping on a floor and I'm hustling and I'm going places. And that can be great, but it can also go to your head and sort of detach you from the reality of the present moment.
So I have a question about these individuals that you worked with that I just mentioned, like Tucker and Dove. They undoubtedly had at least one point huge egos.
Yes.
You can't say they didn't. Like, you can't, it's not like I'm like saying
something. And I wouldn't.
Yeah. It's not like I'm saying something that like I'm like talking about them bad behind their backs. Do you know what I mean? Like, to say like Tucker Max had an ego is not to talk about him bad behind his back. It's
right.
Yeah. So I mean, he's a self-proclaimed, you know, at least he was at one point. And so I wonder how much have these individuals learned and grown in their lives as well? Have you seen a growth trajectory there?
Well, Tucker obviously is very different than when I met him. I mean, he has a family and he runs a company. And I would say there's very few people in his life that would not say that he is radically different. Dove, I'm not close with anymore. We sort of went our separate ways after American Apparel, and he's sort of doing his own thing. I think what I saw working for those egotistical people, and again, like you, I don't mean that insulting, I saw just what a burden it actually was, right? In some ways, it motivated them to take huge risks that paid off in big ways, but I mostly saw that ego as a negative force in their life. Like, because my role was often to have to battle that ego, not for my own personal gain. I wasn't like fighting against Dove's ego so he would promote me. It was like I was fighting against Tucker's ego so he wouldn't do some dumb thing that would be not in his interest, or that I would be fighting his presupposition or strong opinion about a person that he never met that I actually thought that if he could connect with would be good for his career, right? So as a sort of an advisor and a marketer and employee and partner in a lot of cases, I was just so exhausted with, and not just with these two people, but battling other people's egos is just so tiring because it's almost like a superhuman force. It's not rational at all. And so you have to just chip away at it just to get them to do something not stupid.
Totally. And the main point of your book is that battling your own ego is exhausting too.
Yes, of course. And I think, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, this person has a huge ego and it causes problems for them. I think what I spent a lot of time trying to do in the last couple of years is looking at the ways in which being around these egotistical people at such a formative time in my life, when I held them up and at such a place in my mind, how have I picked up some of their bad habits? You know, it's like if you grew up as a child of an alcoholic, you're going to pick up certain habits, both, you know, biologically and culturally. And I certainly got some of that just being in that ego 24/7.
It's just what a learning experience. It's almost like, you know, you read some of those books, like I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, and it's like textbook, like the point of your book, like
sure.
It's weird how life works out. Like
it is, and obviously, I saw none of that at the time.
Interesting. Did you just think it was cool?
I thought it was funny, right?
Funny.
And that's what's so interesting. Like for instance, I don't know a Kanye West, but I would imagine I have seen this. Like I've spoken to these people that, for instance, know Donald Trump. And their opinion of him is radically different than my opinion as an outsider. And part of that is because it's very hard to be sort of destructive and difficult like these people are and be successful unless it's combined with an immense kind of charisma and, you know, sort of adeptness at personal relationships. And so, like, they experience a different Donald Trump than you and I do watching him as a raving lunatic on television. Right. And I think with Tucker and some of the people that I work for, what you're experiencing is not the obnoxious side of their ego. It's being tempered by the personal connection you have with them. So I didn't meet the character version of them. I met a different one.
That makes complete sense. I can see reading your book. I can see how you're obviously more than the sum of the parts, but I can see, like, I read certain sentences and I'm like, oh, that was so Robert Greene's Influence. Like, every probably, time, every time you say that, I like literally like broke it down in my head. Like, every time you say the word reality, I'm like, there's Robert Greene's in it.
Yeah. Sure.
Every time. And then I sense the Stoicism influence, the great Stoics. And I can read a sentence where, you know, you're like, do not be slaves to your passions. Like, oh, that's his Stoicism. So it's so cool. Like, you've had these experiences, and you are the more the sum of the parts. You're more, of course, but we are all. There's like a long chain of things that, like, if you were God, you could explain.
Yes,
you know what I mean.
No, totally. I mean, I love Austin Kleon's stuff where he's talking about that. Basically, people are like, how do I develop a style? And he's like, you basically just imitate other people's style until you put enough of your own touch on it that it becomes your own style. And so I totally agree. I mean, I feel very indebted to Robert. I love the sort of second person style that the Stoics use a lot. Like, they call the reader out in a way that doesn't feel like it's lecturing. It feels like, hey, like, you and me, we both have this same problem. So I try to write that way. And I think I even say this at the back of the book. Like, I feel like if there are any really good sentences in the book, it probably, and I'm not just saying this, they probably are something I unconsciously picked up from someone else. And actually, I worry that I might have memorized some sentence from someone and put in there. One of the things I did with the book is I hired a fact checker to go through and make sure that I didn't do that.
No, that's really smart. That's really smart. So actually, there are a lot of things you wrote in this book that are very beautifully worded, and I'm just going through my notes right now because I want to read some of them that I highlighted. Responsibility requires a readjustment and an increased clarity and purpose. First setting the top level goals and priorities of your organization and your life, then enforcing and observing them to produce results and only results.
That was something I remember. I'm trying to think what book I would have picked it up on. I don't remember what book I picked it up in, but I remember seeing at American Apparel, because I was sort of involved in all these different facets of the company that normally someone in my position wasn't. And what you see is that, like, look, if that basically, as I understand the way that a corporate hierarchy needs to work, is that the board of directors thinks the most long term, the CEO thinks the second most long term, and then down the line until you get to, you know, the janitor who thinks, like, there's a spill right there and I need to clean it up, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, running my own company in my own life, you realize, like, if you're not thinking long term and there's not somebody above you thinking more long term, then you're just winging it and you're going to get screwed, you know? And so that's sort of, I was thinking about the way in which somebody has to determine what the goals or the strategy is in your life, or you don't have one.
For sure. And this idea of like having a North Star purpose.
Yes.
And being consistent in your values and your actions is so important for well-being, you know, like, that's what creates an integrated human being. And that's...
Well, and if you don't have that, how do you, especially, and I've found, you know, being somewhat fortunate that I get a lot of incoming stuff, like, hey, do you want to do this? Like, hey, I'd like you to write that or whatever. How do you know what to say no to if you don't know what you're trying to do? And, like, obviously, I think it's harder to talk about that because it feels like such a first world problem. And most of the people in, like, the sort of self-help space or the readership, they're trying to get anything going. But I think the reality is you must be inundated with, like, requests. Like, you can choose what you're going to research, right? Or what you're going to write about. And so if you say yes to everything, then how do you know what the right thing to say yes to? How do you know, you know, when you've made the wrong choice? Like, if you don't know, you end up just sort of going wherever the random deal flow takes you.
Yeah. And you also, yeah, absolutely. And you don't create the sense of coherence or meaning.
Totally.
Yeah. Find out why you're after what you're after. Ignore those who mess with your pace. Let them covet what you have, not the other way around, because that's independence. You know, the humanistic, great humanistic psychologists of the 50s and 60s, Rollo May, you know, like these people I'm obsessed with, like Abraham Maslow, being inwardly free is how they describe, is kind of the ultimate of life. And you're kind of striking at the core of that there.
Have you ever heard of the band Lucius? They're one of my favorite bands. They have this song. I forget what the song's called, but there's this line in it. And she says, I think it's a girl. She says, there is no race. There's only a runner, or there's only the runner. And I think you got to think about it that way. It's like, if you think that you're in a race with all these other people, then you have to measure yourself about whether you're beating them or not, or, you know, you have to keep their pace. But it's like, you don't know. I actually realized this. I was in college. The first thing I ever wrote is actually about this. It's on my website. I don't know when it was, but this would have been like 10 years ago. But I was running. I would run around this like sort of dirt track at my college. And I was running. And then this other guy, he started running. And I could tell that he was racing me. And I, you know, I'm competitive and I wanted to race against him. And then I realized but I've already been running for like 3 miles. Like if I keep pace with this person, I don't know when he's going to quit. I don't know how long he's been running before. Like, so if you just randomly compete with people because they're like in the same proximity to you, that's like a recipe for totally burning yourself out or making a big mistake because you're lacking all the context you need to make that decision.
Absolutely. So, you know, Manuel Miranda, who
yes.
Hamilton, and did you know that quote he said from his interview in 2020 about he's like, I wasn't the smartest kid in school. I'm just like paraphrasing and butchering his quote, but I wasn't necessarily the smartest kid in school. But what I did is I picked a lane that I knew I could run fast in, and I just ran. You know, he's
that's
like,
that's great.
Yeah, it's a great quote.
I'll totally
put it in the show notes. So, okay. So again, some of these quotes from your book that I've highlighted are beautiful in different ways. This next one is beautiful just in terms of aesthetic appeal to the sentence. Ego is a wicked sister of success.
My premise is that ego manifests itself differently depending on what you do, right? Like the egotism of a loser is going to be very different than the egotism of a billionaire, right? And so I think one of the crazy things is that as you become successful, not only are you, if you're someone who's saying that you're great all the time, but if you do something, then other people are going to be telling you that same thing. And so in that way, success can breed egotism or breed, it can compound those illusions that you already have about yourself.
That's great. Okay, next one. A person's job is to create work. An idea is not enough. The hard thing isn't dreaming big.
Imagination is essential, but if it stops with imagination, then what good was it?
Yeah, and that's the next quote. Our imagination in many senses an asset. Is it weird that I'm like quoting you in front of you?
It is strange.
It's dangerous when it runs wild. So our imagination in many senses an asset is dangerous when it runs wild. So you're saying imagination is still good, so I should have a job as a scientist who studies imagination.
Of course.
However, you know, not coupled with reality at all, right? Not constantly being tested can be a problem.
I think that's a huge part, but also because people can live in this sort of fantasy world, but also if you're not picking the best of your imagination and then, you know, making it real, like putting work behind it, that's the other problem. So it's like, how many people have ideas for books? Like, for instance, like I think there was like 500,000 books published last year because of self-publishing now. It's like radically expanded it. That's awesome. But how many millions of people had this exact thought? Oh, you know what would be a great book idea? Like blank, you know, insert. But how few of those people, only 500,000 of them actually did it?
No, yeah, it's a good point. I mean, there is like, you know, it's coupled with your whole idea in a chapter about talk less, you know, do more. So you actually, isn't that like a quote from Hamilton as well when he's giving Hamilton advice? He's like, let me give you some advice. Talk less. I don't know. Anyway, you say be less or do more is a direct quote from your book.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. I've been trying to understand this. So when you say be lesser, you actually, you contrast to say to be or to do. My conceptualization of being is a little bit different than what you put into the book or what you describe as being. And so I don't think it's incompatible because I think like learning to be is really important in the sense of being your full self and having authenticity. So I think it's interesting. Can you tell the listeners a little bit what you mean by being and how that differs from this sort of doing?
So that chapter is based on a speech that John Boyd has become famous for called the To Do or To Be speech. And if you don't read the book, just Google the speech because it's like amazing. And it's in a bunch of articles. But he's not saying like, don't be yourself. He's saying there's a difference between sort of like, and look, he was coming from a military background, particularly like the bureaucracy in the Pentagon. He's like, don't be the general who has like, you know, 3 stars on their sleeve. Do the work of a general who has that, right? So he's saying there's a distinction between like all the trappings of success and like the real work or influence that a successful person can have. So like what I say in the book is like, there's no aircraft carrier named after John Boyd. You know, most people have no idea who he was, but he transformed the armed forces. Like he shepherded the F-15 and the F-16 through. He was the genius behind the grand strategy of the first Gulf War. He was a brilliant mind who influenced a lot of people directly and also sort of set up this network of protégés that had an immense amount of influence. But he wasn't concerned with like rank or kissing asses or, you know, getting attention. He was just he was focused on the doing rather than like the getting credit or getting the rewards of doing.
Oh, I hear you. You know, there's in school, a lot of kids are labeled as gifted, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like it's a being thing, right? Like you're gifted. Like it doesn't say anything about what you've actually done in the world. And, you know, a lot of adults as well, it's still, they grow up and it's still part of their identity. It's a strong part of their identity. They say,
yeah.
Basically, I'm a gifted adult. And, you know, it's tricky because in life, you know, people tend to appreciate more what you actually do than, you know, there are these transitions in life where it's important. So it's really interesting. Okay, here's another quote. Ego tells us that meaning comes from activity, that being the center of attention is the only way to matter. So is this something that you discovered when you started learning more about what the functioning of the ego is? That, yeah, can you unpack that a little more?
This came more from, I think, my own struggle in the sense that it's really hard for me to do nothing, like to just sit there and feel like good about myself. But if I'm working on something, all of that emptiness or doubt or insecurity goes away. Because like, especially if you're good at whatever it is that you do, right? So it's like, I could go to a party and it could be awkward or I could feel, you know, insecure or whatever. But if I was at home sitting on my computer, writing would be going well, right? Because I'm pretty good at it. So I think there's a certain ego in sort of gravitating towards what comes naturally to you, to your strengths. I think work addiction is rooted in both insecurity and ego at the same time, right? If I stop doing, I will be nothing and everyone will forget about me and I will be worthless, right? So I'm not remembering exactly where that quote comes from. I think that's what I'm referencing.
Maybe you're quoting yourself.
Yes.
And you just forgot. No, that's an excellent point. And then you say, and I think related to this, you say ego blocks us from the beauty and history in the world. It stands in the way. You know, I mean, that's a direct linkage to your prior book, right? The obstacle.
Yeah.
In the way, right?
Well, I mean, if you were to go to like, I don't know, some Civil War battlefield near you or some beautiful, you know, national park, what would you see? You'd see a bunch of people on their cell phones not paying attention, right? Like we become so detached from the world around us because we're focused exclusively on, you know, our work email or, you know, the bickering with someone or whatever is going on. And I think, you know, one of the ways that we sort of deny how ephemeral life is and how vulnerable we are to the world is by focusing exclusively on sort of modern shit. You know, like we don't like to be humbled by nature, I would say generally. And so we avoid it. You know, you walk through the redwood forest in, you know, Northern California and you see a bunch of trees that are like 5 times older than you will ever be, right? It sort of reminds you just how sort of inconsequential you are to...
But I think that's a really all inspiring experience.
No. That's exactly what I'm saying. But most people don't seek that experience out enough. Like our modern lives are essentially a denial of that feeling, right? It's like we predict the weather. You know, we live in safe housing. We can turn on the air conditioner when it gets hot. You know, like we have, through our genius as a species, insulated ourselves in a lot of ways from the nature. But the idea that the world is relatively indifferent to your existence is, I think, an inherently humbling idea that not a lot of people contemplate.
I'm really glad you made that point, Ron. There's my friend David Gayden came. I don't know if you read the paper recently he did where he had people simulate like being from space, and he also he called the overview effect.
I love the overview effect. Yeah,
you've heard of it. So and a lot of astronauts describe just like, and that's the kind of the ultimate humbleness. You know,
yes.
More than just the trees, but actually just looking at your whole planet as like a little like pin drop. You know, a little dot. And yeah, this research suggests it does cause this entire shift in your whole perspective of yourself and your ego. I'm just really glad that you made that point in the book.
No, I'm fascinated by the overview effect. There's two things. One, the guy who has that famous quote, the astronaut, I'm forgetting his name, he just died. But he has that one where he's like, you know, you look at the world and you just want to, he's like, you just want to grab the politicians by the collar and shake them and say like, you son of a bitch or something like that, which I love. And then there's another one where it's like some astronaut who is like alone in the space station, like he took this photo of Earth. And the writer, I think, observed this. Someone was like, what's crazy about this photo is literally everyone who's alive on Earth is in this photo except the guy taking it. And like, so how, you know, like how humbling and crazy that vantage point is.
Then couldn't that go both ways though, just to be cheeky for a second?
Probably.
Couldn't that give you a huge ego to be like, you know what? I'm special. I'm the only one in the entire planet that like
it's not in this photo.
Like, what,
yeah.
Like if Donald, like for instance, if Donald Trump was like up there, right?
That's how he would take it.
Wouldn't he reinterpret that in a different way?
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, the Stoics talk about taking Plato's view all the time, and there's this famous dialogue. I think it's from Lucian? But anyways, there's this famous Greek poem about a guy who gets wings and he's able to float above the earth and he sees like the Roman army fighting another army and he says it looks like ants and, you know, all that. He's able to look at the world. It's interesting, like our viewpoint, like what we get flying in an airplane, it's interesting to think that it was only within the last 100 years that it was even humanly possible for us to look down upon humanity and really grasp how infinitesimal we actually are. So I love that. I think it's inherently ego killing to think that way.
It is ego killing. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And you know, there are a lot of people that are like, they're obsessed with living forever.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I'm just curious if there's an individual difference. Like a lot of people aren't obsessed with living forever. You know?
Yes.
And there are a few people that are like, they're like, I'm the authority on the world and everything. And I think that when I'm so optimistic that we'll live forever, it's like,
every once in a while, you know, you read one of those articles about like a woman who's like 118 years old and, you know, they're like, what's life like? You know, and they're asking all these questions. She's never like, there just hasn't been enough time. Like, you know, like she's never like, I gotta live for 5 more years. They're always like super chill and they're just like, when I die, I die. It's totally cool.
There's something really comforting about that for people who... You know, I mean, I have existential questions. That's normal. You know,
yes.
That's not ego necessarily. I mean, that's like, you know, what existential crisis indicate is that you want to make sure that you have as much meaning in your life as possible. And that's kind of a signal to you that maybe you're not maximizing
right.
meaning. But it is very comforting to know for all people, you know, young people out there listening to this, you know, like if you have these kinds of fears, like chill, like when you get there someday, you won't be as obsessed with this. You know,
yeah.
If you live a meaningful life. If you kind of live your life in a way where you, you know, follow these principles that you talk about in the book, that you have a purpose and you do it, it's comforting to know that like someday when you're on that deathbed, hopefully you'll be very old, you'll actually be okay. You'll be like, I'm cool.
Yeah. Or is it Daniel Gilbert who says like one of the beauties of cognitive dissonance is that like whatever you're anxious about, if it actually happens, you won't. Like your mind will find some rationalization for.
Yeah.
So like maybe you actually will be maybe there actually will be things to regret, but your mind won't actually let you feel the regret that you're dreading.
Yeah. The literature is called effective forecasting.
Yeah.
You're right. And Laura King has done really cool research showing that the difference between people who regret things their whole life and people who don't, they both have had the same amount of regretful experiences, but the difference is they've actually like quantified it. It's really cool. I can send you the review paper if you want to read it.
Yeah.
I find that those who live at the very end of their lives, they're like, you know what? I don't have any regrets. They have done deeper work, cognitively processing and making meaning out of all the trials and tribulations and alternate identities that they didn't accomplish in a way that makes them kind of like okay with it. You know, they're like, you know what? That's cool. That had meaning. My life had meaning because I didn't take that.
Right.
So yeah, related to that, you say there was no grand narrative. You should remember you were there when it happened. I love that quote. Can you unpack that a little bit?
We were talking about this a little bit earlier, is that, you know, you, in retrospect, you can create some clarity out of events, right? It's like, I did this, which led to that, which led to this, which led to that. And now I'm, you know, the best in the world or whatever, you know, story you tell yourself. But you should remember, like, you didn't feel that way at the time because it didn't really exist, right? It was, and coaches talk about this, like Vince Lombardi is, he's like, at the end of, let's say, a Super Bowl winning season, although the Super Bowl didn't really exist then, the end of the season, you can look at the fact that you won and say, like, we won for these reasons. What you never seem to do is go like, hey, remember when that ref blew that call in the third quarter to our benefit? We wouldn't be here if that hadn't happened. So all of this is like, you know, not our doing. And so I think it's interesting when you look at the narratives that we have, how self-serving they are. They either make us much better than we actually are, or they make us the victim in a way that we probably fully weren't.
That reminds me of a golf, you just triggered a golf quote in me. The great failing is to see yourself as more than you are and to value yourself at less than your true worth. That's the great failing. Both those directions.
Yeah, right. And I talk about the golden mean a little bit. I don't think that – I'm not saying that humility is the opposite of ego. I'm saying that humility is the midpoint between, say, ego and like self-loathing. So I think humility is like the perfect balance, or I would say confidence and humility in some ways are synonyms.
Awesome. Ryan, I'm sending you right now a link to this whole research literature that I've been doing some research on called The Quiet Ego.
Oh, awesome.
And it's just so much in line with that. And also relating to the death thing, they found that when they kind of experimentally manipulate humility, like experiment manipulate it, people fear death less. So that's actually a direct test of this idea that narcissism is associated with your fear of death.
Interesting.
I'm going to send you this right now before.
Okay.
Okay. So you talk about the difference between alive time and dead time. And that's something that one of your mentors taught you, right?
Yeah. That's from Robert Greene. It was when I was thinking about leaving American Apparel, I had about a year left that I needed to sort of do, not contractually, but I'd only had the position for, you know, a relatively short amount of time. I needed to put more time in. And Robert was just like, look, you know, this year can be a lifetime for you or a dead time. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he basically meant, he's like, you know, you can get every second out of this and you can use the benefits of your position to meet people, to do research, to develop relationships, you know, to learn and to take things sort of slow. Or you can just sort of ride this year out and then start, basically, he was like, you want to write a book you want to be a writer after you leave. You can start writing the day after you leave, or you can do all the work that you need to do before that time and get a head start. And that's what I ultimately ended up doing. And I think that's I credit that very much with being able to sort of get this career off the ground maybe quicker than other people might be able to.
Good. So his advice worked.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was great. And I try to think about it all the time. I think you don't just apply it to, hey, you know, I signed a 4-year contract with the Marines and I've got, you know, a year left. It's also like I'm stuck in traffic, or, you know, my friend was supposed to meet me at 4:00 and they just texted me to say they're not going to be here till 4:45. What are you going to do with those 45 minutes? Are you going to play, you know, Angry Birds on your phone, or are you going to read a book or make a phone call or go for a walk, or, you know, what are you going to do?
Ryan, I want to ask you a question about this, because I feel like I'm very aware that life is short and that we need to maximize our time. But I find that I can get too obsessed with like, oh, well, I have a full day free.
Well, that means I can write 4 blog posts and 5 journal articles, as opposed to actually like getting like pleasure. Like, you know, there are things I miss, like, you know, like watching movies that are just stupid, you know, like comedies, you know, thing. And because I think I can get too addicted to meaning. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with that. The idea that you have to squeeze everything productive second out of every minute,
exactly.
I think is, you've got to understand that, you know, the body is not a, even actually, no, maybe you do see the body as a machine. Machines can overheat and break and wear down if you don't treat them well.
Good. I like that resolution. That's good justification for binge watching on Netflix.
Look, you got to know what's going on in the culture, man. That's what you tell yourself.
Good. Good. Okay. Thanks for that reconciliation. Okay. So what's the difference between ambition and sanity?
So that's from a quote from Marcus Aurelius. He's saying ambition is tying yourself to other people, right? Because like if you want to do something or be recognized that, you know, you want to become a Roman physician. So like you want to be consul or a general or a senator, that requires other people doing what you want, right? Someone has to grant you that position. You have to be elected. So he's saying ambition is tying yourself to something you don't control. He's saying sanity is tying it to your own actions. So like, for instance, my book is out this week. If I tie my happiness to writing a good book that I'm proud of, to working hard on it, et cetera, that is sanity. Tying it to whether it hits the New York Times bestseller list or sells an arbitrary number of copies is insanity because I don't control those things.
So that kind of, and this is, we'll end with this note. I mean, that really strikes the heart of what this book is all about. I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment. What happens when our ego, in a way, the thought experiment is kind of like this. Like, what happens if like we die and our work still goes on? Like, what do we really care about in life? Do we care about us living forever, our ego living forever, or our work to help the world as long as possible? It's kind of it kind of lies at the heart of a lot of what your book is about, right?
I think that's true. Although there is a certain amount of ego in those people, and the Stoics talk about this a lot, who lust for this posthumous fame, right? Like, oh, I need generations to hear my name forever. You know, the Stoics are like, what do you care? You're dead. You know, like, I have
that's
a line.
That's so Stoicism. Like, all the Stoics.
I have a line. I don't think it's in this book. I think it's in something I'm working on now. But it's basically, it's like, you know, Alexandria is named after Alexander the Great, but he's dead, so he has no idea that it still exists. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And so you, what does matter is what he did in his own life, often, you know, terrible, awful things that couldn't have made him feel good either.
Right. No, that's a really good clarification. And when you take the ego out of the equation, though, I mean, you do see, and as your book shows, you that you have a greater likelihood of making an impact on the world.
Hopefully.
So I want to leave on that note because I think your message gets across in really loud and clear. And I think it's a really terrific book. So thanks, Ryan, for being on
Thank
the show
you.
And for writing this book.
Well, I'm so glad we bumped into each other at a random Mexican restaurant in Malibu 5 years ago.
Me too. I look forward to the next podcast chat when the next book comes out.
Thank you.
All the best, Ryan. Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
healthier.com.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.